ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Colleen Patrick Goudreau, author of the book, The 30-Day Vegan Challenge. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
From One Green Planet, eating fish is widely considered an important part of a healthy, balanced diet. Fish are packed with omega-3s and is said to be a wonderful source of protein. The accolades of fish seem to grow more and more every day. However, as we begin to learn about things like fish factory farming and overfishing, these pro-fish testimonials start to get a little, well, fishy. Our global appetite for fish is putting a massive strain on marine ecosystems, but this is not where the mal-effects of consuming fish end. We are not only taking large amounts of fish out of the ocean, but we're constantly dumping plastic, trash, and other forms of pollutants into the oceans. While it might seem like we can continue to dump waste into the ocean without any consequence, it looks like what we put in, we are getting out, all wrapped in the package of the fish we consume. Mercury contamination in fish meat is one concern, but consuming plastic particles is a growing issue. The strangest part of this pescatarian plastic plague? The plastic is coming from our clothing. In 2011, ecologist Mark Brown published a study which made a rather shocking discovery. The world's oceans are filled with tiny plastic microfibers that come from our clothing. The majority of the clothing that we wear today is made of synthetic material, basically highly flexible plastic fibers that are cheap to produce and require minimal maintenance. Brown traveled to 18 different shorelines across the world and found that 85% of the sediment along those shores were composed of microfibers. How did bits and pieces of your clothes get along those shorelines? Laundry. Every time a single piece of synthetic clothing is washed, it releases 1,900 plastic microfibers into the water. These microfibers are carried out of your washing machine and diverted to sewage plants or local waterways. The fibers are too small to be filtered out of the water and end up washed out to sea. Microfibers are typically smaller than 5 millimeters, so they're easily ingested by marine life. Microfibers can contain endocrine disruptors, neurotoxins, and potential carcinogens. Plastics also act as pollution sponges and are able to transfer harmful chemicals from the marine environment to fish who consume them. Studies in California have found microfibers that have absorbed heavy metals, PCBs, fossil fuel compounds, and the harmful compounds found in flame retardants, all of which get passed up the food chain, ending on our plates as food. The findings teach us a very valuable lesson about the karmic cycle of pollution. When we are constantly putting pollution into our environment, it will inevitably make its way back to us. The best way we can keep this from happening is to stop the pollution at its source. Be mindful of the materials your clothing is made of, and always look for natural fibers such as linen and organic cotton. And if you don't want to consume plastic along with your seafood, the most logical move is to eliminate fish from your diet.
Sea Shepherd Conservation Society reports that in an attempt to undermine freedom in their own country, 29 of the 33 members of the Faroese Parliament voted in December to ban Sea Shepherd volunteers from coming to the Faroe Islands. After Sea Shepherd's successful campaign to protect pilot whales and dolphins this past summer, Faroese politicians decided to take the drastic move to stop further Sea Shepherd intervention by simply banning Sea Shepherd volunteers from the Faroes. This move certainly illustrates that many Faroese politicians have acknowledged the effectiveness of Sea Shepherd's campaigning. This law would be a blatantly discriminatory policy that would ban people for their beliefs. However, this did not concern the 29 members of parliament that had their blind obsession to defend the slaughter of pilot whales and dolphins at all cost. The problem for the Faroese, however, is that how do you ban Sea Shepherd volunteers who happen to be members of the European Union? Banning members of the EU would cause a retaliation of banning Faroese citizens from Europe. A law banning Sea Shepherd would also have required Danish approval, and Denmark was not about to head down the road of censorship and discrimination. The Faroese claim that killing whales is a tradition and part of their culture. On the other hand, the Danish view freedom, democracy, and human rights as part of their culture. Further, killing cetaceans is a violation of European Union law, and Denmark is a member of the EU and provides subsidies to the Faroe Islands. The Faroese claim that they are independent, and for that reason, they insist the law doesn't apply to them. Last year, more than 400 Sea Shepherd volunteers traveled to the Faroe Islands to oppose an event that the Faroese called the Grindadrap, which translates to murder of whales. 33 whales were killed during the three-month period that Sea Shepherd volunteers patrolled the islands. The year before, in the same time period, more than 1,300 pilot whales and dolphins were massacred on Faroese beaches. Sea Shepherd is committed to opposing the Grindadrap no matter what obstacles are placed in their way.
Milk doesn't do a body good. More and more research is showing that dairy products, including yogurt, are not the health panacea that the industry has led us to believe for several generations. In fact, the reverse is proving itself to be the truth. In the mid-1960s, a 20-year study at Fairfield University in Connecticut reported that drinking milk may be even more dangerous than smoking cigarettes. The study found that consuming homogenized milk products allowed small amounts of the enzyme xanthine oxidase to pass into the bloodstream, resulting in hardening of the arteries. The study estimated that consumption of this enzyme in homogenized dairy products was responsible for an estimated 500,000 deaths each year in the United States. Since the early 1980s, numerous studies have reported that 90% of the world's population lack the ability to digest dairy products. The main culprit has been identified as casein, a complex protein that becomes virtually indigestible through pasteurization. As a result, dairy products currently share top honors with wheat products on the list of foods that cause mucus and allergies in the human body. Also, the level of protein is 300 times higher and phosphorus 50 times higher than those found in human milk. There is increasing evidence that this can cause a calcium deficiency, resulting in osteoporosis. Finally, the presence of increased hormones and antibiotics in the milk supply due to current farming techniques is suspected to contribute to a variety of degenerative diseases, including liver and kidney disorders. More recently, a report from Johns Hopkins University describes milk and dairy foods as a problem child to human health. The dairy industry has always responded by saying that milk and dairy products are necessary to get enough calcium and protein for optimum body development. The truth is that dark green vegetables and sprouts, grains, and nuts are higher quality sources of both calcium and protein. Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, author of a number of books, including The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion on Being Vegan, and her new book, The 30-Day Vegan Challenge. That's coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for being with us, Colleen.
Thanks for having me.
Colleen, could you start out by telling our listeners how you got involved in vegan cooking and eating?
I am an animal activist. I've been an animal activist for, 20-something years, coming to it through having read Diet for New America. And you know, even though that book is specifically about the animals we eat, it really had sparked my concern, just my innate concern about animals, that I'd always been an animal lover. So I was just reading everything I could about, you know, animals in laboratories, animals in circuses and zoos and puppy mills and factory farms and slaughterhouses, and, you know, just kind of you take it all in, right, when you first become exposed to this information. And then as I continued on that journey, I really delved deeper into the food aspects and found that that was a place where I could really have an impact in terms of really making a difference, in terms of giving people what they needed to stop eating animals. So I started tabling. I was doing Meet Your Meat video displays and showing people Meet Your Meat, which was a PETA video. I imagine it's still around.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. And just, you know, handing out leaflets and just really exposing people to the information that is hidden from us that I hadn't known that when it was exposed to me, it changed my life. And so what happened was I found that people were incredibly open and moved when they saw these videos and were exposed to this information. But their next questions were always, but what do I eat? And where do I go? And where do I shop? And what about family and all the social aspects of the nutrition? And right, all of the questions that people ask. So I wanted to be able to give them those answers. And, you know, my background's in English literature. I have a master's in English literature. And communication has always been a huge part of my life, whether it's written communication or spoken communication. So it's not that it was such a huge leap, but in terms of, like, cooking, I had liked to cook, but I never saw myself making any kind of career out of it. But when I felt that people, when I saw that people were asking, what do I eat? I don't know what to cook, and how do I get my nutrients? I just started teaching cooking classes because I felt it was something I could share with them and give them what they needed to do that. So that's how it started. It started with cooking classes in a Unitarian church that I was going to at the time. And that led to everything that I have today, which is, you know, the cookbooks and the podcast, et cetera. But it all started with kind of hearing what people were asking for. You know, what can I give them that they need, that they want to make this change in their lives?
So you weren't actually a cook or anything before this all started.
Nope.
And now you've come up with all these cookbooks and over 600 recipes.
And my favorite cookbook, The Joy of Vegan Baking, which I rely on heavily. I love every recipe in that book. They're all delicious.
And we love Liz for loving it because
yeah,
you get to live off the bounty.
So your new book is The 30-Day Vegan Challenge. Mm-hmm. Why did you come up with this idea?
So I'm always really paying attention to what people need and what I think would work for them to make the changes that reflect their own values. So what do people care about and where are the gaps for them and what are the challenges for them? And so this concept of the 30-Day Vegan Challenge came to me several years ago. And I just, you know, it's not a unique concept. The idea that you can just commit to doing something for a short period of time. People have done this for years in whatever field. It's really appealing to me, and I think it's really appealing to people because they don't have to say, I'm never going to eat meat again, or I'm never going to eat dairy again. That doesn't mean that's not, you know, that my intention isn't to give them what they need to completely make the change. But it's manageable for people because they can say, I'll do it for 30 days. Now, what I know is that what happens in that time period, if they're really reading my material, if they're really doing it, if they're really, you know, reading the book, is a foundation is being laid for them so that at the end of the 30 days, they have the skills and the tools and the resources to continue. And it works. It's, you know, most people say, and you probably encounter this too, I never, ever encounter someone who, when I say I'm vegan, doesn't say, oh, I don't eat a lot of meat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we hear that all the time. I only eat brisket at Easter.
Well, and they, right, exactly. But they believe it. They really believe it. And I really believe that they believe it. Their perception of themselves is that they don't eat a lot. And so what this book, this concept, this program says is you don't know how much you eat until you stop. So just give yourself this time to say, oh, instead of going over here and eating all the things and going to the same restaurants that I'm so used to doing by habit, what's over here? Because in this time period, I'm doing something different. And you start to see things you never saw before, and it expands your experience, and it opens up your mind, and it opens up your heart, and it's just brilliant, and it works, and that's the whole concept behind the 30-Day Vegan Challenge.
You know, from a psychological point of view, too, most people believe that if you can make a change for 30 days, then it becomes much more permanent.
That's right. I mean, any behavior modification expert would tell you that it takes 3 weeks to change a habit. That's kind of the number. So sure, you get 3 weeks here plus the extra week, and that is the whole concept. The thing is, what happens when people change habits is, and this is where people fail, because everything we do is based on habit. The way we eat, we were all raised to eat this way. It's all habit, right?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when people make a habit change, where they fail is they remove what's familiar, but they don't replace it with something new. And that's what this does, is say, okay, you're not doing X, Y, and Z. You're not consuming meat, dairy, and eggs anymore. But let me give you everything you need to stand on a strong foundation so that they're not flailing about, because that's what happens. We see people start, you know, they'll do it on their own, or they'll just say, like, oh, I'm not going to eat meat, dairy, and eggs. But then, you know, after a short time, they really haven't replaced the foods, the habits, the restaurants. They don't have the tools, you know, that kind of thing. So
sometimes bow into peer pressure. Like, they try it for a while, and then all of a sudden someone brings donuts or their favorite whatever to some event, and then they're like, okay, I did it for a week, but I really can't resist this any longer.
Right. And that's why I spend a lot of time getting underneath what appears to be on the surface, right? It's not just about, like, the donuts smell so good, you know, and they do, because it's sugar, like flour. And sugar and flour, from, as you know, from the Joy of Vegan Baking, right, tastes really good. So getting underneath what it is when someone brings in a donut, or even more when they bring in cheese, or, you know, they smell the familiar smell of, you know, a steak or whatever it is, you know, one chapter is specifically on cravings, that it's not about the donut, it's not about the cheese, it's not about the meat, but it's usually about something familiar. It's usually about a certain mouthfeel, a texture. It's about fat. It's about salt. So how can you still meet the cravings that are being triggered by the familiar animal-based food, animal-based product? How can you still meet that craving, but in a plant version? So that, I spend a lot of time going underneath what we think is the real issue, and I spend a lot of time on the social aspects, because peer pressure is really huge, because we are a minority in a world that consumes a ton of animal products.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, in your research, what did you find is the comfort foods that people had the most difficult? You touched on cheese and things. What other things do you think are really present the greatest obstacles to people making the transition?
I really think it's cheese. I really think it's cheese. I mean, you know, some people talk about eggs, but, like, how many people are like, I can't live without chicken's eggs? I mean, like, really? Like, I think, like, most of us can live without chicken's eggs. So here's what I do. People come to me, Tom, and they'll say, I've thought about being vegan, but there are just certain things I love I couldn't live without. And I say, okay, what is it? And they'll say, well, like cheese. And I'll say, in what form? And they'll say, oh, like, I love spreading brie on some, you know, bread, or I love a scramble, or I love a hard-boiled egg. So what happens is, once they tell me what form they're used to eating that thing in, then I can help them even further, right? Or if they even say eggs, same thing, you know, the scramble was related to that, right? So I love eggs. Well, how do you love eggs? Is it the hard-boiled egg? Is it the scrambled egg? And then I can say, oh, okay, well, here's what that's doing for you. Here's that mouthfeel, and here's how you can get that in plant food. So it's so important for us as advocates, I think, to really hear what people are saying, as opposed to discounting their attachment to that thing, as opposed to saying, oh, that's easy. Oh, no, I was the same way, but I can, no, it's easy, no problem. No, like, they're really challenged by this thing that they're attached to. So what is it that they're attached to, and what can we give them to help them still get the thing that they want so badly?
Yeah, we got to have a big block of plant-based fat.
Yeah. Or, Colleen, I really miss escargot. Well, why don't you try some boiled okra?
Well, you know what's funny? There are certain things, honestly, if they really say, I mean, how many things is it? There aren't that many things. And when people would say something like that, like, I really miss escargot, I mean, honestly, I would probably say to them, you could live without escargot. Like, how important is escargot, right? Or meringue, right? I mean, I think someone's working on vegan meringue, and sure,
oh,
great.
Good.
But, like, yeah, great. But, like, how deprived would we be if we went the rest of our lives without eating meringue. I don't know. There's some point at which we can say to people, like, what's more important? Like, you know, you living according to your values or having meringue, right?
Right. And Tom was telling me a couple of weeks ago he found vegan lard. And I wondered, have we gone too far now?
It was vegan bacon
grease. Yeah. Vegan bacon grease.
Wow.
Yeah. So apparently that's a form that people need, I guess. So.
Well, I remember I grew up, you know, in a house. I grew up in a house where my mom used to pour the bacon grease into a jar. I mean, that's what they used to then fry the eggs or what have you.
Cook the pancakes.
The pancakes. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the neat things I saw in doing some research on you was you talked once about how compassion and having compassion as a kid is really something that you admire in children. And you look at the kids and if they're, you know, they're caring about animals, it's a great thing. But somehow when people become adults, if they're compassionate towards animals, society looks upon that differently.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? There is a perception that you're not as strong or strong-willed or you're weak or you're emotional or... Yeah, it's really interesting, and yet I think that compassion and empathy is what we really value in each other. It's just that we're kind of playing these roles with each other in our society too, right? I mean, just different roles that we play just in general, so I think we feel like we have to hide certain things about ourselves or pretend we're someone we're not. So it is really interesting, and that's why I do spend a lot of time talking about the pride that we should have being compassionate, empathetic people. What's the alternative? You know, lacking empathy and lacking compassion and just being cold-hearted. I mean, none of us value that.
Right.
And it's interesting. We talk about that when I talk about people who do the killing, people who do the slaughtering. You know, it's really interesting. You have two sides of it. If you have someone who says, oh, I could kill animals with no problem, I have no problem doing that, that's scary. Like, we don't want to interact with those people, right?
I have my knife for slashing throats in my back pocket here.
Exactly. Like, we recognize that as a pathology, and we're not comfortable with that. But then the flip side is, it's really hard. I can't do this. It's too hard. It's too emotional. That's the truth of it. But what happens is we desensitize ourselves to it. So in order to cope with it, we have to desensitize ourselves to it. And so I think that hardening that you alluded to, Tom, about us being suspicious of compassionate adults, because if we let our guard down and if we open our hearts, it means that we're going to have to make changes that are going to affect our lives. And I think that's ultimately the key in terms of people making this change. I think everyone's on the fence. I really honestly think people are just on the fence. They know that it doesn't take much to just push them over, and they hold themselves and protect themselves because it's the change they're afraid of. They don't know what their lives are going to look like. They don't know how it's going to affect their relationships. They don't know how their family's going to react. They don't know what it's going to mean for the holidays. They don't know what it's going to mean for them going to their grandmother's house who used to make macaroni and cheese for them. So they hold on to all of the myths that they tell themselves, and they harden themselves to the reality of what we're doing to animals because they know if they knew, they would be compelled to make a change. And that's why it's so important for us to tap into the hearts of the people we're talking to and to get the information out there to people.
Yeah, I think that's a good point because you do see how defensive people can be about their diet. And I mean, I think that makes sense that really they're just afraid to take that next step and think about, you know, making the transition.
Yeah, they're defensive. They also won't even look, right? I mean, how many people do we encounter who say, don't tell me, I don't want to know.
Right.
I don't even want to look at that. Why? It's not because they're hard-hearted. It's because they're soft-hearted. It's because they know if they saw what's really happening, they would be moved.
But once they do know the truth, once they've been exposed to it, I don't understand how people can have the apathy they have.
There are a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, again, we live in a society that supports us being asleep to it. We live in a society that supports us in eating as many animals as possible and, you know, exploits animals in many ways, too. So in all these ways, our lives are kind of built around what we do to animals. And so, you know, people who are influenced by those around us and the peer pressure, it really means a lot to people. And that's why, I spend a lot of time in my work talking about just speaking up and being confident in who you are and what you believe in and understanding the difference between, you know, where you end and another person begins. A lot of people are afraid to rock the boat. And they think that if someone's offended by them being vegan, that they've done something wrong. Now, right. There's a difference mm-hmm. between setting out to offend someone and just being who we are and offending someone.
Right.
Or just offensive by nature.
Or, yeah, I mean, some people are just offensive by nature, I suppose. Yeah. But, you know, there is a difference, and we have to learn that as a skill. If we are setting out to, like, make someone feel bad because they haven't made a shift or we think they're bad people, whatever, like, that's, like, not okay, and people will read that. But if we just stand up as who we are, as joyful vegans, and say, I'm vegan, and I love being vegan, and someone is offended by that or takes it the wrong way, that's not ours. And yeah. that's where we have to learn the difference so that we don't not speak up because we think that, you know, oh, I've rocked the boat. Well, I mean, we have to be willing to rock the boat or make people uncomfortable. Nothing changes if things aren't kind of shifted a bit.
In your book, The 30-Day Vegan Challenge, I mean, what are some of the benefits once people do make that transition?
Well, I mean, there are so many. I mean, that's what's so lovely about it is I often say that I don't care why you're coming to this. It's not my business why you're coming to this, because once you do, you're going to have so many unexpected changes and just you're just going to experience so many things that you never expected to. And you're also going to experience some things that you can measure. So, you know, the beginning of the book, I talk about, you know, things you can expect to lose, things you can expect to gain, and some things that you just can't even expect at all that you're just going to have to be open to. So, I mean, so certainly, I mean, we know that, you know, a healthy body is all about blood flow. I mean, there's no mystery about that. And we know that meat, dairy, and eggs hinder blood flow. And we know that plant foods encourage blood flow. And when blood's flowing, then everything's going where it's supposed to, and we aren't at risk for the kinds of diseases that are related to our blood. So if there's no stoppage going to our heart, we're not going to have a heart attack. If there's no blockage going to our brains, we're not going to have a stroke. So it's pretty basic, right? So what's so exciting is that when people do this for such a short period of time, I think people are really surprised that in such a short period of time, they can see changes that they can measure, like in their cholesterol, like in their, you know, triglycerides and blood pressure, et cetera. What I love are the unexpected changes that happen, and that's why I am so encouraged by people, because I see people make these changes and then their hearts open. Then they look through a lens that they had never looked through before. They start connecting with animals, you know, and their compassion for animals that they never had before. So my whole mantra is just be open and let the experiences happen and be open to what experiences you encounter.
Colleen, can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your new book and about your work?
Sure, yeah. I mean, my website, Joyful Vegan, has everything people need. They can also go to 30dayveganchallenge.com and find the online program as well as the book.
We've been talking with Colleen Patrick-Goodreau, author of The 30-Day Vegan Challenge, as well as a number of other books. Thank you for being with us, Colleen.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for what you do.
When you're thinking about doing something special for your loved ones this Valentine's Day, be sure your gift is a compassionate one and consider something thoughtful like dairy-free chocolates, organic flowers, or support a local restaurant that offers vegan options.
Join the Vegetarian Society of El Paso for our winter dinner on Saturday, February 21st at the Sunland Park Holiday Inn. Our guest speaker will be Erica Meyer, Executive Director of Compassion Over Killing. Our reservation deadline is Tuesday, February the 17th. For more information about how to make a reservation, please visit our website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen to Past Shows button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.